I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. It is Tuesday, January 27th, and it's snowing in Portland. And I see that those from the South are here anyway. Well, Senator Morissette's here.
Well,
and
I just wanted to sit back and see how it is to listen to what's going on in this
community. Yes. I'm so glad that I didn't have to make that commute, but
so it is snowing in Portland.
In Portland, but it's supposed to go away. And
eventually. That's what they said in Spokane after they got 70 inches.
All right. We have nursing board bills, and two of them have been pulled, but they will be coming back. But I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 139. And do I have the sheet witness registration? I think Holly Hart is the first and only person.
I have a 9 o'clock, 8:30 breakfast meeting, so will we be done in that?
Good morning.
And we are in a subcommittee right now.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Morissette. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Nursing.
Oh, I gave the wrong name. I was thinking of another Holly. Okay. Sorry.
No problem.
It's Holly Mercer.
The mission of the Board of Nursing is to safeguard the public's health and well-being by providing guidance for, regulation of, and entry into the profession, nursing education, and continuing safe practice. The board has a total of 9 members and is comprised of 2 public members, 2 licensed practical nurses, and 5 registered nurses. The board and its staff of 45 regulate the practice of approximately 70,000 licensees, including 18,000 certified nursing assistants. The ratios of licensee to staff is 1,500 to 1. The board's budget of $9.7 million is funded primarily through license fees, but does receive some federal funds for a certified nursing assistant program. The agency is comprised of 3 main sections: licensing, investigations and compliance, and administration. Administration includes programs for education, advanced practice, nursing consultation, and certified nursing. As the chair previously mentioned, we pulled 2 bills yesterday, Senate Bill 137, which had to do with fingerprinting for primarily applicants for our employees at the Board of Nursing. That concept is also included in House Bill 2118, and we will watch that bill as it goes through the process, and we will continue to talk to our stakeholders about fingerprinting of our employees. We also pulled Senate Bill 138. We learned through many phone calls yesterday that what we had intended in that bill was not clearly stated, we believe, in the final bill, so we will continue to talk to stakeholders and try to work out our differences and bring it back to this committee as soon as possible. I am here today, however, to provide testimony in favor of passage of Senate Bill 139. This bill removes the statutory requirement for the board to produce a wallet-sized card as evidence of licensure. Currently, a nurse or certified nursing assistant renews their license every 2 years. So a licensure card indicates that the licensee completed the application form, paid their fees, and was approved for renewal. The card, however, does not indicate whether that licensee has had any encumbrance or discipline on that license during that 2-year period. We believe that this bill increases public safety by compelling healthcare employers to verify licensure by using the board's online system or telephonic verification methods. Major employers accredited by the Joint Commission are already required to perform real-time verifications. With passage of this bill, we would like to move the culture toward increased safety by compelling all healthcare employers, whether they are large hospitals, rural clinics, or private individuals, to use real-time verifications. As part of this shift to real-time information, within the next year, we will be introducing a subscription service to employers where they can receive daily or weekly updates regarding the licensure status or of their employees. They will be alerted if their employee's license is due for renewal or whether that license has lapsed. They will also be alerted if discipline has been issued on that license. Since approximately 60% of our licensees work for five major employers, we believe that this subscription service will have a very positive impact on public safety. We do understand that at times licensees need some evidence of their license number. We will need to design some form of evidence of licensure that encourages anyone looking at that card to verify current licensure and whether or not there is any encumbrance on that license. Our goal is to protect public safety by encouraging all employers to check real-time licensure. We believe this bill moves us in that direction. The board thanks the committee for its consideration and urges passage of Senate Bill 139. I am open to any questions, Chair.
Thank you. So there will be nothing sent to the licensee at this point then. They'll send in their application, process it, but they won't receive anything back.
Chairman Anderson, I believe in terms of implementing this, of course, for the 85% plus of our renewals, which exceed 35,000 licenses per year, this should be quite seamless in that they will be able to print off some indication of their license number when they go ahead and apply online. We will have to, on our paper applications, because currently we do not license through on new applications and endorsements from other states, those are done on hard copy paper. So they may get something back for a period of time, but we definitely want to move all of our applications and renewals to online within the very near future.
It would save quite a bit of money. Have you penciled that out?
We have penciled it out. We believe we spend in a biennium about $51,000 in supplies and about $42,000 in resources. We, however, believe that we can definitely use that, and what we want to do is use those resources for audit, which we have not been sufficient in terms of our audit function over the past several years. So that is the direction we want to go with those resources.
Okay. And when would the implementation happen if this bill passes?
We would have to get the rules through, but we intend to implement as soon as it passes.
But would you be able to be online for employers?
Yes, in fact, we are designing that system currently within our current budget. We intend to have a rollout of that subscription within the next 6 months. And when we send out our newsletter in this next quarter, we will start informing employers about the possibility of that subscription service. We're very excited about that. We're working through another state in terms of they've already designed the project and the subscription service, and it is being used in other states. And so we're very anxious. I think that's going to make a big difference to our employers.
Could the public be able to access that?
The public now can access verification of any licensee that is within our control. Currently, they can go online, look it up by name, and tell whether or not there is any discipline at all on that licensee.
So the encumbrances would be just privy to employers?
No. The encumbrances, once they become public, they go into our verification system, and you can either go online and look by name, or you can call and say the licensee's name, and you will find out whether or not that licensee has an encumbered license.
Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Bates.
Identification of the licensees through this system. A hospital wants to hire a nurse. Nurse comes in. How do we know if the nurse we're looking at across the desk from us is the same one that's on the internet? Do you have a picture ID there, or some other method of confirming that situation?
Yes, so what you have is somebody that's already licensed by us. And what you want to do, what you're saying is the employer needs to verify that the person they're interviewing is the...
Correct.
Yes.
Is actually the person who you think you're interviewing. That's been a problem in this state and other states. It's an identification problem.
In terms of a nurse imposter type of thing. I will look into that, Senator Bates and Chair Mona Sanderson, and get back to the committee about specifically what we can access in terms of cross-identifying.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Because right now they can, it's difficult for them to get a card. Of course, there's not a picture on our card.
No, there's not. In fact, I don't know. As Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Bates, I have a nursing license in three states: Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. I don't have a picture on any of those cards.
It has been a problem, mm-hmm. and it's going to be a problem. And this might be a way of dealing with that problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's other people doing this in other fields, and so.
Are there any concerns with this bill? With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 139 and open a work session on Senate Bill 139.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 139 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 139 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I appreciate the... need to move along, but we have a Senate rule which requires that we have a fiscal and revenue impact statement before
we don't have to
move along, and
yes.
I don't have that yet, even though there may be some fiscal and revenue impact on this. So I would suggest that maybe wait.
And Madam Chair, maybe we should. My sense is the revenue, the impacts will be negative.
It'll be negative.
Sure.
Is there a process where we can pass it out of committee, but it doesn't leave to go to Judy till we get the fiscal? We actually have to have fiscal in front of us. Chair Mona Sanderson, I believe that we faxed that. We believed that we had submitted it previously, but we faxed it yesterday and to your office.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I submitted our request to fiscal a couple of days ago, and they have not gotten back to me yet.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Thank you. I suggest we wait until we get the fiscal and then have a work session and pass the bill out.
Okay.
Madam Chair, allow me to withdraw my motion.
All right. All those in favor of the motion being withdrawn, is there any opposition? All right. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 139. And as soon as we get the fiscal, it isn't necessary for you to come back, but we will be having a work session.
Thank you very much.
Bob will let you know. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me about that. Okay. All right. With that, we're going to move on and start our conversation with finances in the hospital system. As you know, on the other side, in the other chamber, they're dealing with provider taxes, et cetera. And I thought to lay the groundwork, it would be very interesting for the hospital and the health system to give us a financial overview of the hospitals. So the Oregon Association of Hospitals is here to present their information. And I need a witness.
Maybe they'll rescind their order.
The names. So it's Tom Holt, Kevin Earls.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
But they asked for it.
It just came to me.
Good.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Holt here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and with me is Kevin Earls, Vice President for Public Policy and Advocacy for the Association. I appreciate the opportunity to give you just sort of a baseline overview of where hospitals are in the economy and financially in light of the rather large issue we're dealing with in healthcare reform in this session. So just a little bit about who the hospitals are. There are 57 of them statewide. 25 are the large so-called DRG hospitals, and DRG just is a code for a billing class, and those are mostly urban hospitals. And then there are a dozen rural type A's that are less than 50 beds and are more than 30 miles from another hospital, and 20 that are also type B and less than 50 beds, and they're less than 30 miles from another. Some stats from 2007. There were 7,500, roughly, licensed beds. There were about 350,000 acute discharges, 1.5 million patient days served, about 8.4 million outpatient visits, and 450,000 home health visits by hospital staff. If you think about those numbers a little bit in the Oregon population, that works out to a couple of encounters with a hospital for every Oregonian based on our population. In terms of economic impact, we have a little better than 55,000 employees, pay pretty good wages, nearly $50,000 a year. Of course, that's weighted by there being a lot of licensed health professionals working for the hospitals. The total payroll, around $2.7 billion, and an economic impact of $7.8 billion, and that's a combination of payroll, other revenues to the hospitals, the supplies they buy, and so on. And all those figures are from 2007. This is an important chart. This shows where the hospital patients get their coverage from. And these color codes are somewhat intentional. The yellow slices there are the individual and small group that I think we all realize are a fairly fragile portion of the market. Those are the people that are most likely to drop off insurance as costs go up. To the right is the large group domestic insured patients with Oregon companies. In the bottom, you see Medicare in green, and to the left you see the self-insured ERISA plans, also in green. Those two slices are regulated by the federal government and not by the state. And then the 11% kind of orange slice is Medicaid, and then red are the uninsured, about 16%. And it's just sort of an interesting factoid to me that we have about the same number of self-insured as we do uninsured. Now that plays into the payment mix when they get into the hospital as far as who the hospitals are able to bill to. Medicaid bills at about the same level as their population as far as coverage, about 11%. Medicare close to 40%. And then a small slice of self-paying patients. And then the kind of gold shade here is the commercial market, which is all commercial plans, and that would include Medicaid managed care. Now the red shading is also a bit intentional because those Medicaid and Medicare patients are serviced at below hospital costs generally. And the gold and commercial is also intentional because that's the golden goose that makes it all balance out. We have to cost shift to the commercial market in order to make Medicaid and Medicare viable. This is another way of looking at kind of the same information, but it gives you a little more specifics. Although these numbers are a little bit old now, they're through 2004, and what it shows you is that the lowest payers, there's a number, if you look at the 100% threshold, that's cost, and so you see Medicaid at about not quite 70% of cost, and Medicare around 85%. And then all other plans, the commercial plans and individual payers, up around 130%. So that increment above 100% is that's where people are cost shifting and paying for the underpayment of the public plans.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Morris.
Question? Thank you. I believe you said that in the commercial mix, it includes Medicaid managed care?
Yes.
What would that be if you broke that out so that you're looking at true commercial as opposed to a managed care included in it for Medicaid?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I don't know the answer to that question offhand. Kevin, do you have an idea?
I don't have the
answer. We can get that number for you.
My point is that the cost shift to the you know, the group plans, business and public, it doesn't 44% doesn't represent that true commercial payer.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Morris, Kevin Earls for the Hospital Association. I think another way maybe of framing this that's helpful from a policy perspective is if you think of, in its simplest terms, the hospital business really has three customers or so, Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial. And as Mr. Holt said, we are routinely underpaid by Medicaid and Medicare relative to cost. So hospitals lose money on average on every unit of service that's delivered to Medicare, Medicaid enrollee. I think the point that Senator Morris is making is, in effect, 100% of a hospital's ability to stay financially viable depends on the margin that they get from a commercial payer. So it is the takeaway from our perspective is that having a viable, self-insured and fully insured commercial marketplace in Oregon is absolutely essential for hospitals in order to stay in business, because all of our margin comes from commercial and our ability to offset the losses that we have from Medicare and Medicaid.
Senator Morrison.
Yeah, thank you. There's another segment of the population that's kind of hard to understand in terms of numbers, and that's the people who can't afford hospitalization, who go to the emergency room. And I guess I'm interested in the impact of that. Now, we have a $500 million hospital in Springfield, and it's interesting because it is a nonprofit, and if it had been a for-profit hospital, that would be a significant boost to the tax base. What's the obligation of nonprofit hospitals to deal with the public? Now, I know there's charity, and I understand that those who are not able to pay are automatically counted in that area. I don't know. But I'd like some information about the nonprofit hospitals and their obligation to the community that they're in. In lieu of taxes, what kind of services do they provide?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we'd be pleased to provide specific information about any hospital, and I can tell you from our own tracking of what we think of what you're describing in kind of in two realms. One is there is uncompensated care, which is charity care, and also bad debt.
Okay.
And the two of those in aggregate are uncompensated care. The other thing that we think about for hospitals in terms of how they return in exchange for tax forgiveness or not-for-profit status, mm-hmm. is what they do in terms of community benefit. So those might be programs that they run where the program is a benefit to the community. It routinely loses money. The hospital subsidizes because it's an important service. What I can tell you about the two hospitals in the Eugene-Springfield area is that they're both very active in terms of providing uncompensated care and community benefit to the communities that they serve. And we'll give you the specific numbers. Yeah. I think it's quite impressive and dramatic.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I think, and Senator Morris said, it's a good segue to the next slide. So we're going to get into a little bit of the uncompensated care and what's happening in the ERs. The important thing to take away from this slide is not necessarily the hard number, which shows about three-quarters of $1 billion in uncompensated care through 2006. But we all know that that's a billed charges number, and we all know that the billed charge is not necessarily what people end up paying. The important thing there is to look at the trend. There's been a rather dramatic rise in recent years of uncompensated care. And that's something that doesn't show in those payer slides that we were just looking at. The total cost shift...
Go back to the slide for a second.
Yeah. Senator Bates.
I've seen this slide before. I've also seen one superimposed on it that shows what's happened to OHP Standard and the OHP program, and they're complementary. As that program's died down, the other one's gone up. So reinvigorating OHP could dramatically affect this slide. And there's probably other factors involved. It's not quite that simple, obviously, but it would be interesting if you could have superimposed the OHP population on this, because I think they're pretty well parallel to each other, going in opposite directions.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we actually track this data on a quarterly basis, and there, to your point, there is a point, I think it's the third quarter of 2003, when there was a significant downturn in OHP standard, and it is absolutely perfectly identifiable in the quarterly data. You can see when the light switch went off on OHP standard and when uncompensated care took an immediate quarterly uptick for hospitals in Oregon.
Thank you.
The total cost shift amounts roughly to about $1.7 billion annually at this point.
Wow.
And that plays out to, at a consumer level, this is a really busy slide, but this is a chart out of a report that just came out from the Healthcare Leadership Task Force, which was put together by Oregon Business Association, Oregon Healthcare Underwriters, and a couple of other organizations to take a look at this issue. And I think the takeaway here is if we look at the portion of health costs to the consumer due to the cost shift, and you look at the number for what a typical family of four pays for coverage through their employer, around it's about $300 a month now for premium. About $150 of that premium is for cost shift. That's a really significant burden on consumers. And then you add in some of the cost sharing co-pays and so on. And the total number works out to a little better than $180 a month for the consumer. So as that goes up, obviously people make choices, not necessarily the ones they want to make, about whether or not they're going to continue to carry the coverage that they have, or their employers may make that same decision, and it has an impact overall on sort of the spiral of uncompensated care and Medicaid, ER visits, and the whole nine yards.
Madam Chair, if I could just expand on that for a minute, I think one of the reasons why we think this slide is particularly important in the context of your discussions this session is, as many of you know, the cost shift that we face as providers is really a combination of Medicare and Medicaid. And from our perspective, Oregon's ability to affect the Medicare cost shift is pretty limited so far. We think that's an important issue, and I know it's one that Senator Bates has on many occasions expressed concern about. The Medicaid payment rates, however, are something that are entirely within the control of this body and the agency that governs Medicaid in the state. And connecting the dots back to our earlier comment, or my earlier comment about 100% of a hospital's ability to manage its margin depends on a healthy commercial population, an insured population, the commercial market. And when I say healthy, I mean a healthy marketplace. It is absolutely essential that we don't increase the cost shifting on the thing that we can control, which is Medicaid, or, as you will discuss, around provider taxes, increasing the liability that hospitals face in trying to balance those books. So we think it's really important that you consider that viability of the commercial marketplace as you think about how provider taxes might be structured in this session.
In terms of just where hospitals are and financial condition generally, the margins have dropped rather dramatically over the last several years. This data is through mid-2007, down about not quite 25%. And you can argue whether or not that's the right margin or not, but the trend is important. And you'll note that dips under 4%, and that 4% is a significant figure this session. What do we do with the margin? Well, the association likes to say if there's no margin, there's no mission. They go to reserves to provide some buffer against hard times like we're in right now, to deal with sort of unscheduled, unknown, unforeseeable events like the huge snowstorm that imposed some short-term bumps in costs. They go to endowments that throw off income to pay for some of those community benefit programs, charity care, and of course then basic capital improvements and maintenance.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Moore.
Question, please. Thank you. Would it be possible for you to break those margins down by the DRG and the AB hospitals so we could look at least three basic categories? Because I suspect when you're approaching an average of 4% that there's some of the DRG hospitals are actually outliers to the norm of hospitals in the state.
Chairman S. Anderson, Senator Morris, absolutely, we can pull that data together for you, and you're correct. I mean, it's an average, and there's going to be some significantly above that and some that are right on the zero line.
Another helpful piece of information, at least for me, is on the individual hospitals. Can you break down in broad categories their individual budgets? You know, rumor says that for some hospitals, they require 6% building, 6% of their budget must be devoted to capital improvements. And I want to know how that fits into this mix.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
I believe in the 05 session when we had very large discussion on cost containment for hospitals and so on. The representative from the association showed me a book, a fairly large publication that had information for each hospital in the state. And he was showing me the comparisons between, for instance, some of the nonprofits who had a very good operating margin as opposed to some of the for-profits that had a very small. That's Peace Health versus McKinsey Willamette, which was private at the time. And the difference between the operating margins, and that's why I'm kind of interested in what happens to that operating margin for nonprofits and where that money goes. But my question is that publication updated? Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I am. And I think the source of that originally was a collaborative effort between our offices and the Office of Health Policy, which collects data on hospital financial performance monthly and quarterly and annually. We have recently, within the association, updated that information, and we'd be pleased to provide a copy that shows every hospital in the state and perhaps some summary information that aggregates, as Senator Morris was interested in, breaking out the A's and B's and the DRGs.
Oh, that's wonderful.
We'd be pleased to do that for you. I think, this is an opportunity to talk about kind of one thing that, there's that old adage about retail. It's, it comes down to three things: location, location, location. Well, in the hospital business, it comes down to kind of the same thing. It's just patient mix. And as we talked about earlier, for Medicaid and Medicare, hospitals lose money generally on those patients and make it up on commercial. A critical thing to think about when you look at individual hospital performance is taking it in the context of that patient mix issue.
Thank you.
Or payer mix is another way to think of it. Because you can take two hospitals that are in the same community and are only modestly miles apart, and they have radically different circumstances. And I the one that I think is really instructive is are two hospitals that happen to be within the same system, Legacy Meridian Park and Legacy Emmanuel Hospital, both in the Portland area. They're maybe, I don't know, they might be 10 miles apart. Radically different payer mixes. Meridian Park is quite successful. It's in an affluent suburban area of Portland. Legacy Emmanuel is in the inner city. It's a tertiary care. It's a level one trauma center. It has really high Medicaid mix.
Again, Meridian Park has very little Medicaid, high commercial. So two hospitals, same management, same system, radically different performance. Some of that gets lost in a system because those things wash each other out. The margin that you see from Meridian Park helps offset losses at Emmanuel. But back to the kind of location issue, as you look at individual financial performance of hospitals, recognize that some of the performance that you see, a great deal of the performance you see, is driven by that critical issue of payer mix.
I'm sure. Speaking of location, what about the certificate of need that would, in the metropolitan area, where I understand hospitals are kind of invading each other's territory now. Is there a concern about that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, certificate of need is a challenge. I think the biggest challenge for hospitals right now is not so much the competition between hospitals in a common market, although I think that's an important consideration. The big challenge for hospitals these days is that there are private investor-owned facilities that are coming into the market with rapidity to pull out services that are profitable from a hospital's service mix. So you see ambulatory surgical centers, cancer centers, optical surgical centers, those specialty things that you have seen are radiological endeavors, businesses, MRI centers, those types of diagnostic things. Those are increasingly being developed by private investors, and they target just the services that a hospital has that are high margin. A hospital uses those services to offset areas where they lose margin, and as those things get pulled out by private investors, it undermines our financial viability. That's a much bigger issue for us, frankly, than the competition between hospitals.
Just to follow up, is it true or not true that in the metro area that there is no certificate of need for hospitals, that hospitals are able to purchase land and build, or purchase a small hospital and build, in direct competition with a hospital that may be in the very sweet spot that you just mentioned a little while ago to, you know, dilute that profit? Now, is it true that there...
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, no, there is a certificate of need law in Oregon, and in fact, it only currently applies to hospitals.
Okay. Let me just take another
minute
here.
But not for expansion, I think.
Yeah, okay. When I testified in Eugene about the certificate of need for McKinsey Willamette, and I was told by the hearings officer that the only place we do not have a certificate of need is in the Portland metro area for hospitals. And I suggested that they do the same thing for Lane County. But so that's what I'm basing my statement on.
I see, and I understand it. Actually, Oregon's kind of limited certificate of need law is a state law, so it applies everywhere uniformly. But it, again, in its current form, it only applies to hospital facilities, not to non-hospital.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you.
Turn off your cell phone, please.
Not me. Okay. Got a new phone, don't want to work it, so I think I got it turned off, okay? Kevin, first, Madam Chair, Kevin, I appreciate your comments, and you actually put information that will answer most of my questions. There's one other issue, though, that I'd like to have you have a comment on, if you could. In the last 4 or 5 years, hospitals have enjoyed, as a group, fairly good margins. Okay, not great, but fairly good margins. And they've used that for a lot of different purposes, but some of those purposes have been to build up their reserves and invest those reserves. And my concern is, what's happened to those reserves? You put away money for a rainy day, the stock market's collapsed. where are those reserves now? And if that's proprietary and you can't share it, I understand that, but I would like to have an understanding, because what we're going to look at here ultimately, I believe, is we're going to go hospital by hospital in this situation, see where each hospital is. And part of that discussion should be what's happened to your reserves, which for many hospitals have very limited ability to affect when your stock market's dropped 50%. I assume reserves have been hit pretty hard, too. So I'll comment if you could.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, thank you for the question. If you think about how hospitals finance their operations, one way of thinking about it is their operating performance. So their primary business, which is patient care. And then you can also separately think of non-operating income, which is, as the Senator is referring to, kind of investment income. And I would tell you that in good times, hospitals often use investment income to try and subsidize the performance on their operational side, on their patient care side. But unfortunately, hospitals have fared much like the rest of us in the stock market with performance on investments. And so in this kind of environment, hospitals have seen a dramatic downturn in the value of those non-operating reserves, and the performance of non-operating income is actually a negative on most financial reports for hospitals. A specific example might be useful. Over the weekend, I received an email from one of the bond rating agencies, specifically about the hospital in Klamath Falls, Sky Lakes, and that they had been downgraded from a 3B to a 2B bond rating because of significant losses on the investment side and because of a downturn in their financial performance. And many of our hospitals are seeing a dramatic downturn in elective surgeries and other kinds of things as individual Oregonians delay things that are kind of on the margin, somewhat discretionary. So hospitals are feeling that on the operational side, and they're getting hit on the income side. The effect of that in Sky Lakes Hospital in Klamath Falls case is that the cost of borrowing, the cost of debt for them, will go up significantly as a result of their downturn in their bond rating. That's probably more of an answer than you wanted, but it is, as you would suspect, that hospitals have had the same kind of downturn in the value of their reserve portfolios that the rest of us have.
Back to Senator Morissette's question regarding certificate of need, that applies just to new hospitals, not for expansion of hospitals. Correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Moving on, really a tag on a little bit to the last question in terms of, you know, there's a myth that healthcare is immune from economic swings. As Kevin mentioned, there's, you know, we're seeing a dramatic drop in the elective procedures that people can put off or not do at all. Year over year, there's been about a 4.5% increase in ER visits. Anecdotally, it's a little too soon to confirm it in data. We're hearing larger increases in ER visits in the last several months. For the period ending in November, about a third of hospitals reported negative operating margins. The trend has been accelerating. And our November data shows a little more than half, about 60% of the hospitals lost money on operations. Now, again, some of that gets backfilled through endowment and other sources, but those sources are also under pressure. It's not a great time to be fundraising right now. Borrowing costs are up and the markets are tight, as we all know, and endowments have taken a hit. Now to one of the, I guess, to the kind of central issue we have in the session, I want to talk a little bit about the provider tax. I think most of you were here when it got created back in 2003, but just to refresh everyone's memory, this was something that the association initiated initially as an idea to mitigate some of the cost shift in our income streams. And by federal law, the way that those work is they have to be uniform, that is the same rate across the same type of taxed entity. They have to be broad-based, pull in everybody within that class, and they have to be redistributive. There have to be winners and losers. Some are going to come out ahead, some are going to come out behind. In the aggregate, under the current provider tax, hospitals and the other participants in the provider tax come out even in the aggregate, but there are, again, winners and losers, and that is done for hospitals through the fee-for-service Medicaid reimbursements. Now, the last time we went through this bad stuff in
just
the budgets,
to reiterate yes. that point, the more Medicaid clients you have, you're a winner compared to those that aren't with the provider tax, is what you're saying.
Madam Chair, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Could you flip back to the last slide for a second, too?
Madam Chair, I'd like to clarify, because that's an important issue. The issue for hospitals in participating in the provider tax program is not their individual relative winnings or losings, but rather what is the aggregate impact. And there is some mitigation that occurs as a result of hospitals participating in the program. Hospitals aren't better off per se by having more Medicaid. As we saw earlier, they actually lose money on every unit of service, so they have more Medicaid, they have more losses. What is created is when you have more Medicaid, the reason that Oregon's tax works in the aggregate to return the tax liability to hospitals is because payments are increased, because they're so far below cost, there's an opportunity to increase payments sufficient to return the tax liability to hospitals. So I wouldn't want to leave anyone on the committee with the impression that hospitals benefit from having a higher Medicaid level.
But you are better off participating in the system than if you didn't, because your reimbursement is better.
Well, it's, Madam Chair, it's frankly more complicated than that. Let me give you an example. Yesterday on the other side of the building, there was a presentation by an economist from OHSU that's been doing some work trying to model the effects on individual hospitals of various scenarios under a provider tax. One of his own key assumptions is that when patients go from a state of uninsurance to a state of insurance, as they would through being added to the health plan, their consumption of health care services increases by more than threefold. So remembering that hospitals lose about 40 cents on the dollar for each unit of Medicaid service on the average that they provide, they're in effect experiencing an increase in the units of service that somebody will use when they go from an uninsured state to an insured state, by that economist's measure, over three times.
I still need clarification on the fact that when you provide, and wouldn't it, the system work, though, if you are a participant in the provider tax system, that your reimbursement rate would be better than if you did not participate in with the provider tax?
With Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me answer it this way. The way the tax works, and it's a complicated beast, but we've had 6 years of experience working with it, is in effect hospitals pay a tax that are in the 25 hospitals, they pay a tax that's in effect a loan to the state. The state leverages federal money with that. Then they pay the tax liability in the aggregate back to the hospitals that paid the tax. The reason that that's important is that it's revenue neutral to the hospitals in the aggregate. Why that's important is because otherwise you create cost shifting, an increased cost shift to commercial purchasers. There is a very strict limit under federal law about how much you can play that game. You're only allowed to pay increased payments on Medicaid up to the rate that Medicare would have paid for the same service. So my point is this. We have a tax rate today of 0.63%. It pays for approximately one-third of the revenue to pay for 25,000 Oregonians. We nearly maximize how much we can pay back to hospitals under that tax. We have always worked to maximize the amount of federal matching money and hence the tax rate. But you can't simply go from 0.63 to 4% or 40% or some higher tax rate and have it just work out. If it were as simple as that, our work would be done. We would finance the entire healthcare delivery system in Oregon simply by taxing hospitals. But under federal rule, we have a very strict limit about how much payments can be increased to pay back the tax liability. I hope that's responsive.
Senator Bates, yeah.
And I'm going to complicate this more, not help you, but and also remember, just to follow your comment there, that in Oregon, with low Medicare rates, we're really restricted to on this situation. And, you know, and remember also, in some states, Medicare pays the full cost of hospitalization, and there's actually some arguments it pays more than the full cost in some states. So we are subsidizing those states. It's very difficult for our hospitals and our providers in states because Medicare is such an incredible mess as far as payments concerned for certain states. I mean, it's really an unjust system that can't be maintained. There are some other issues here that I want to bring up real quickly to you also. Going back to some things we said about location, and this is goes to what the chair has been talking about. We've tried to set the tax up in a way there are no real losers in the system, and that may be something we're going to lose. Because if you're in location, you have a high Medicare base, a high Medicaid base, you will be a winner. And if you've either chosen or by luck landed in an area where you have a low Medicaid situation, you may end up being a loser. And that's not only for hospitals, but for some physicians who have chosen not to take Medicare, not to take Medicaid, and only take commercial payments. Okay, so there's some parallels there between both professions. The other issue we have to remember, too, is when we bring people on board in Medicaid, and I think this goes back to, I'm assuming this is Dr. McConnell we're talking about. Our experience has been when we first bring somebody back on to an insurance program, they do start consuming more, but they don't continue that. They have pent-up demand, I think is what you may be seeing, and I like to see the rationale behind those figures. Because remember that one slide we saw where your unreimbursed care is shooting up as OHP standard was lost. Hopefully, in the long run, being OHP standard back at 130,000 lives or whatever the number is going to be, you'll see a dampening effect on both sides of that for the hospital. I can't guarantee that, and I've got to call into McConnell to talk to him about this, because I'm hoping when you're looking at something that says you bring somebody onto the Medicaid program and they triple their usage of the system, that is a temporary situation. That as they get into managed care and we bring primary and preventive care into them, that they start bringing this thing under control as far as usage of the system is concerned. I don't know that to be true or not true, but it's an important question, because if truly your Medicaid usage triples when you bring someone onto Medicaid and it maintains itself, we need to look at why that's happening, not just as the raw number, because it shouldn't be happening. Usage through the Medicaid system should go down compared to the uninsured. The uninsured should be hitting hospitals harder, and once they get in Medicaid and they get in managed care, they should be hitting the hospitals less. And so we need to look at the underlying reasons for that, what the underpinning for that number is. I would look forward to seeing that with you, and I'll talk to McConnell about it personally. I've got a call into him already. You mentioned this to me yesterday, and I was like, that just is intuitively not right, but my intuition's been wrong a lot of times before, too, so I want to find out more about that, because that's really a key to this. If by bringing more people into Medicaid under this system actually increases usage of the hospitals, then we're not doing what we want to do here.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I want to make sure that I encourage you to have that conversation, but I want to make sure that I spoke clearly. I'm not saying that hospital services triple, but when a person is uninsured, I think you would agree intuitively they're not going to be freewheeling in terms of their use of the healthcare system. When they go into an insured state, and Dr. McConnell was citing published sources, in academic sources, he wasn't referring to Medicaid specifically, but when rather, what is behavior, how does behavior change when you go from being uninsured and fully exposed to the cost of care to a state where you're insured and you have limited financial exposure? What he said was that that a person's consumption will more than triple of healthcare services. So not hospital only, but of healthcare services.
But
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but if it's in a managed care system, that is far less expensive than where they have only been going for their services through the hospital, the ER. And again, I don't know the numbers here, but the system, our reform system, has to address that issue so that they are going, because in a sense, we want to get to preventative care, and that hopefully is going to be happening in a managed care system rather than just going to the hospital. So the system has to work so that they're not always going to the hospital. Yeah, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin, what you've just spoken to me absolutely goes on with my intuitive knowledge of this. When I see individuals going onto a commercial market, especially certain classes of ones where they have very low deductibles, very low co-pays, their usage and demands and systems from my office is unbelievable. It is freewheeling. They want everything all of a sudden, and it's unbelievable what they're asking for. Everything from every scooter you can imagine, and every MRI you can imagine, every CT you can imagine. Some things aren't even good for them. And their answer is, well, it doesn't cost me anything. I want to go do it. And it is truly an amazing phenomena. Medicaid patients in managed care, I do not see that happening with. It's a completely different class of individuals. And even though there's no cost to them, in managed care, those requirements are greatly blunted. And our experience has been huge drop in ER usage, less hospitalizations, and using the prioritized list, a significant drop in some of the procedures that we normally would see. So that's just my intuitive thing. McConnell, I can have a further discussion about that because it really affects the rest of this discussion. If bringing more people on Medicaid is a negative thing for hospitals, we've got a problem. But I will go back to that first slide, where you saw your uncompensated care going up, OHP standard going down, and the correlation. And I know this conversation is much more complex than we're doing right now, and I appreciate that. So don't take any of this stuff to the bank yet.
Not at all, Madam Chair, Senator Bates. And I wouldn't, again, I want to be really clear that I'm not characterizing having more Medicaid patients is bad for hospitals overall. Certainly there's some adjustment. There's an offset to uncompensated care. But the in the context of the governor's recommended budget, which has a 4% tax on hospitals to finance not only hospital care, but all aspects of health care for a Medicaid expansion adult population, the numbers don't work. That's all I and we simply, from an association point of view, and again, it's a larger conversation that's going to play out in the weeks and months ahead. All we want to communicate is we've always been willing to be a part of a solution around funding expansion for the OHP population. That's how we brought the hospital tax forward 6 years ago. But we know very well about how the program works and what we can do under federal rule in terms of increasing rates and what we can't do. And what we're saying is a narrow tax on 25 hospitals is not able to sustain or pay for all of the health care for 100,000 adults as is envisioned in the governor's recommended budget. And increasing rates won't change that fact. You can't change the rates so much to offset the impact of those taxes. And so we simply want to be a part of a conversation about a much broader tax base, as was recommended by the Finance Committee of the Oregon Health Fund Board.
I know we're focusing on provider tax here, but the, we can't forget, or hospitals especially can't forget about evidence-based type services need to be based on evidence, and I don't know if I mentioned it to you or not, but there is, I was at a conference, I think it was in Utah, and I apologize if I told you this before, but they just took maternity care, which was 27% of their operating part of their budget. 27% of the services went to maternity care. And they went with this evidence-based model. They looked at, they were seeing that their birthing centers were, the cost of having a baby through a birthing center was much less compared to in the hospital. So the hospital started incorporating what the birthing centers did. That means decreased use of epidurals. There was decreased use of cesareans because some hospitals are performing over 50% of their patients that came in were getting cesareans. There were a number of different issues that they looked at, and they actually started incorporating, and their revenue decreased by $340,000 in 1 year by implementing those costs. And what the hospital administrator says, you know, we were using good evidence base, but the revenue decreased by such a huge amount, it really affected our operating budget. So, but I think hospitals have to start looking at that. When I have a physician tell me, and I apologize if I said this again, that they're encouraged to use a 5 multi-dose vial for one patient rather than a single-dose vial just because you get more reimbursement for it, that is wrong. So it's broader. Healthcare costs and cost containment is much broader, and I'm sorry I'm going on that bent, but we are looking at provider tax, but we also have to be, hospitals in particular have to start looking at.
Not at all, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that we all feel like we have to work together to reduce the cost curve of healthcare in our state and in this country. And, you know, you touch on a really critical issue. Hospitals, to a large degree, don't typically have control over the actions of individual physicians. So that's changing over time as we see more employed physicians. But one of the reasons that people have long been enamored of the Kaiser model, the Kaiser Permanente model, is that physicians and the hospital and the health insurer work together to try and manage care and work towards standards of care collaboratively. In our market, a lot of, you know, in the broader market, a lot of times, you know, it's not hospitals that are ordering those services. It's physicians that order those services. And so as we work towards community standards of care or best practices, it's really critical that people understand that hospitals don't have the control over that. It has to be a collaborative effort with the physician community that actually is ordering the services or performing the procedures.
An example of that is induced labor. If you look at some of the hospitals, there's a lot of induction because they want it Monday through Friday and not on the weekends. So there's studies out there that cite that, and that does cost money.
Yes, and the physician OB oftentimes is really prefers not to have to work on weekends as well.
I know.
Madam Chair.
But though patients sometimes want to have it induced too, because they want to have it on certain days. And
that's right, Madam Chair.
So.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morset and Senator Bates.
What's the role of urgent care centers? Now, in Eugene, they closed an urgent care center. Peace Health, I believe, closed it. But I believe a group of doctors opened a new one right across the street from the old hospital on 13th Street, and they also have an urgent care center at Peace Health at Riverbend. Now, tell me about urgent care centers in relation to reducing hospital costs.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, great question. I'd say hospitals have, and I know from our own membership, have experimented with various models of developing urgent care centers in proximity to their emergency rooms. Under federal law, a law called EMTALA, hospitals are required to diagnose or treat and stabilize a patient when they present in an ED, regardless of whether they have insurance or the ability to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Federal law, hospitals are acutely aware of their obligation under that law. As we know, as Senator Bates knows from his practice and other physicians know, a lot of care presents, a lot of patients present in the hospital emergency room for non-emergent conditions. A lot of times it's because there's a lack of primary care access to physicians in the community, and they don't know where to go, so they go to the ED. Hospitals work with urgent care centers to try and shift the flow of those non-emergent cases to a urgent care setting. The challenge that they have, frankly, and this happened particularly in the, I know of the in the Silverton community, the hospital built a brand new urgent care clinic basically right across the street from the ED. Consumers that are uninsured often understand that if they go to an urgent care clinic, they have a financial obligation. They have to present payment at the time of care. But if they go to the ED, they do not. So it's a different incentive for people to present for care at an urgent care clinic. If you're insured, now it can be the reverse. If you go to the ED, you can get dinged with, you know, depending on your policy, maybe a $100 copay because you went to the emergency room. If you go to the urgent care clinic, it might be a $25 or $20 copay. So if you're insured, you know, it does kind of mitigate those that patient flow. But from an uninsured perspective, it's been challenging.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment on what we're talking about here is efficiency in hospitals, and one of the things we should recognize about Oregon that's unusual is the length of stay we have in our hospitals are the lowest in the nation. Cost per day may be marginally higher, but we are running, from that point of view, a very efficient system. Can we do better inside the hospitals? Yes, we can. And I would tell you one of the things when I hear about a 50% C-section rate, you need to understand there's two groups that drive hospital costs as far as what those physicians are doing with their pens and their scalpels, and that's tort lawyers.
Tort.
And to ignore that is silly. Mm-hmm. The actual cost of tort is less than 1% of the total cost of health care costs. But if you look at unnecessary defensive medicine being practiced, it's hard to measure, but we know it's at least 15% of what goes on in the hospital and in general health care is unnecessary care, trying to cover yourself so you don't have a tort brought against you. And it's not only expensive, it's bad for patients. And that's an issue that we'll have to deal with outside of this discussion. Thank you.
Yes, Senator North.
Might I hammer the nail just a little bit further?
Yes, please do.
In discussion with a physician this last weekend, he said, I have zero risk to order. I have total risk if I don't order.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently,
order,
you know what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You have unnecessary orders, and it's the defensive practice. And in the whole context of healthcare reform, if we leave this process with a healthcare reform package that does not include broad-based tort reform for medical services, we have provided a huge disservice to this state.
And
thank you for allowing me to nail it.
Well, I think we need to just
nail it even further. And in talking with a physician just 2 weeks ago, a surgeon, saying, Lori, if you would just get rid of all the different financial plans that I have to go through to figure out what coverage my patient has, I could decrease the cost at least three people in my office because of the huge amount of paperwork that is needed for the billing process.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots to this story.
Here, maybe we should let him finish.
Yes, I think we should. All right.
We've actually covered most of what we had plan to bring to you today, but just wanted to touch on a couple of key points in regard to the provider tax that we didn't hit on, and sort of in the range of issues lurking in the background that some of us are familiar with and others may not be. But over the last few years, CMS has stated very clearly and repeatedly their intent to squeeze out the use of provider taxes. And we need to bear that in mind as we look at, you know, long-term solutions to funding health care in Medicaid. The first step is, of course, happening this year, where the rules have changed on the managed care tax, where it can no longer just be on the Medicaid. Managed care has to be on all. Now, we've seen some illustrations, and folks have talked about, and we understand using as a benchmark sort of the zero option, that the provider tax entirely goes away. I think we want to be very clear that we're not talking about a zero option, that we do think there has to be some interim solution at minimum that includes some form of provider taxes. The 4%, we obviously have an issue with. And just to kind of encapsulate a little bit about, if we look at the present provider tax, it raises about, the last biennium it raised around $250 million or so from all taxed entities. Hospitals were about a third of that. The proposal that is on the table within the governor's recommended budget, and that tax funds the OHP standard. The proposal on the table would be to fund entirely a very large expansion of OHP standard only on hospitals. So it's a very different context, and we think that the kind of rates that would be necessary to make hospitals whole at that level of tax would be impossible to get past CMS in the fee-for-service system. So that's just something we wanted to underscore. But other than that, I think we've covered lots of ground today. We want to just reiterate that, you know, we want to be a resource to you. We'll bring back the data that you've requested and get it to each of your offices. But otherwise, you know, we want to underscore that we do want to be part of the solution and not necessarily an obstacle. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a quick anecdotal story of emergency room and insurance and who's going to pay the bill. We were in an emergency room and happened to be McKinsey Willamette in the summer, and so I got my cards out as we were checking in, and I was told to put them away, that they don't check on people when they come in because they don't want to be prejudiced as to whether or not they can pay if they have insurance, and they check apparently on the way out, if at all, because I see people leaving and I don't know. So it was an interesting twist, and I thought that was admirable in many ways, that they take whoever comes, they take care of them without knowing whether or not they have insurance or can pay for it. I don't know how many hospitals do that, but that was a change from McKinsey Willamette.
Senator Morissette, thanks for sharing that. That's a good story. I appreciate hearing that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I know that this committee, individual committee members, have come to me and said that we really need to be a part of the dialogue for health care reform. And I think this, since a lot of the bills have started, and all of the bills have started on the House side, we are taking a look at introducing some of the policy. I believe the majority office has introduced the same bills virtually, except for those that we can't start in the Senate. on the as Senate bills, and so we will be having the same discussion on the House bills that they're having over there, except for 2009. But there'll be pieces of 2009 that are in the bills that we're going to be discussing here in the Senate. So those will be coming before us. Is there any other questions, comments? We're adjourned. Thank you.